Monster Man, episode 267, Weasel and Web Bird. Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. In today's episode, we're continuing our journey through Monster Manual 2, the 1983 supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 1st Edition. If this episode sounds a little different from some others, it is because I'm testing out a new setup with my microphone. Your feedback is welcome. Before we get started with the monsters, though, I'd like to thank a new Patreon supporter. Yes, this is someone who's gone to patreon.com/monsterman, and they've pledged as little as $1 a month to help support the show. And depending on the level that you pledge at, you'll get different rewards. At the $2 level, you get access to my other podcast, Patron Deities, whereas patrons at the $5 level also get the chance to choose a monster for a special bonus episode. So thank you very much, Dale Houston. Your support means a lot to me. Okay, we are on the home stretch here in Monster Manual 2 as we begin our journey into the W chapter. And the first monster in the W chapter is the Weasel, which the book is keen to point out also covers other small mustelids, such as ferrets, stoats, minks, and so forth. It doesn't really say very much about them, for pretty obvious reasons. They're not really fighters, unlike larger cousins like wolverines. But it does mention that ferrets can be captured when they're young and then trained for hunting. And I actually think that this is a pretty good use of ferrets or weasels or similar in a D&D game. And in fact, I think I mentioned this earlier when we talked about the Germlane. That may have been back in the Fiendfolio, maybe in this book. They all kind of blur together after a while. But when you have smaller monsters who take advantage of the fact that they can move in and out of openings that player characters typically can't get through, right? I mean, even a halfling can't fit into the kind of mouse hole-sized apertures that a germlane is going to come crawling out of. Training ferrets to go in after them actually seems pretty clever. And this goes double if you're, you know, like a rogue could definitely train a ferret to go hunt little monsters. But if you're, you know, a druid or a ranger, you're someone who has like a lot of good animal skills, you know, maybe has the ability to cast speak with animals or whatever, then I feel like they could be really useful. You know, ferrets are pretty intelligent. You know, they might not be able to report exactly what they see, but you could definitely say, you know, go see if there's anybody in that room, or go see if the blue jewel is in there or whatever. They can climb up a drain pipe or something like that. They could get in through small openings. You know, they'd be good for kind of scouting and infiltration. I played a character in, not in a D&D game, but in a Vampire the Requiem game, who, you know, like many vampires, had the ability to talk to and control animals. And while I had the usual sort of, you know, vicious pack of attack dogs and whatever that you'd expect, I also had a pet ferret. And it was actually super useful. You know, you could send it to do all kinds of clever tricks. Now, of course, obviously there you can also sort of project your consciousness into the animal's body, which makes it even more useful. Ferrets are often overlooked. And I think that this is like, you know, that's true of a lot of animals, but it works particularly well for ferrets because they're kind of like fun and playful and cute. People like ferrets. But yeah, like little clever mustelids are great companions to an adventurer. And I think that also there's kind of a, if you've ever listened to the D&D podcast, The Adventure Zone, well, it's not always D&D, but the first season is, and that's the one I'm talking about. There's a moment where one of the characters has this rant about identifying with the mongoose, like the mongoose being the ideal symbol, right? Like little but fierce, clever, capable of taking on much larger and more powerful opponents. And like, I think that that's a good, you know, ferrets are good kind of underdog animals in that sense. Like, we tend to think of them as sympathetic and relatable in a way that we don't necessarily, even with other animals we like cats. I don't know. It's just a thought, but I think that the ferret is a great companion for a player character. Or, you know, for an NPC, like you could have a rogue who had a bunch of like little ferrets. This is sort of like getting into the same territory as the cat lord, but maybe not as overpowered. So yeah, weasels are pretty good. Next we got the web bird, a monster that is absolutely hideous, and that also like is difficult to pronounce because it's spelt W-E-B-B-I-R-D, which should of course be pronounced webbird. But this is a web bird, that is a bird, or at least a bird-like creature, that spins a web. Now, the webbird, see I did it there, now the web bird has kind of two key features. And the first is, they're not really birds, well okay, has several key features. They're not really birds. They have a kind of bird-like shape and appearance, but they don't have beaks. They just have grindy mouth parts. And they have a gross kind of tentacle-like appendage coming out of their chests, which you'd think would mess with being aerodynamic, but what do I know? Now, the thing that I really like about the web birds is that they're a flock monster whose attack kind of varies in power depending on how big the flock is, which I think is really neat. So if the webbirds see you trespassing upon their territory, what they'll do is that they will come together in a big flock and they'll all attack you with their webbing. And so the power of the webbing attack, the likelihood that the targets will be all webbed up and restrained, depends on how many of the birds there are in the flock. So it's a die roll modified by the number of birds that are present. So it might do nothing. I think that's fun. And like a lot of other webbing type monsters, there are additional rules for how you can get it off. So for instance, you can like pour wine over the webbing, and so the alcohol will kind of dissolve the chemical that makes it stick to your skin. It's flammable. It's here described as inflammable, but as we all know, flammable and inflammable mean the same thing. Although I bet that was confusing to a lot of younger readers. I think I was probably in my teens before I learned that. It doesn't come up very often, you know. I remember encountering it in Molesworth and not knowing what inflammable meant. Like, I thought it meant not flammable. It seems like it should. So, as I said, they put their web on you. Then once you're all webbed up, the next stage is that they come down and they use their gross tentacly appendage, which I guess is an ovipositor, to lay eggs in you. Now, this is a bit... there's nothing wrong with this. It's a perfectly reasonable thing for monsters to want to do. But I do feel a little bit as though I'm starting to reach saturation on how many egg-laying-in living body, and then after a while the grubs hatch and you die, monsters I'm willing to deal with. Now, I do like that the monster puts a countdown clock on the victim, right? They don't actually want you to die. The grubs will hatch inside you, and then they do 1 point of damage every turn until you finally die. Like I said before, monsters that inflict some kind of further complication on you are more interesting than monsters that just kill you dead. So, in the game that I'm running with some of the patrons at present, we're running the scenario Lorne's Song of the Bachelor, and there's an NPC with the group who has been, they believe, has been bitten by a tiger spirit, and it's basically a kind of a werewolf situation, that if the bite goes untreated for long enough, he will turn into a tiger spirit. And furthermore, that is not 100% clear how long it's going to take. Mechanically speaking, the way it works is that he has to keep making saves, and once he has a certain number of failed saves, he transforms. So if he needs X failed saves and he takes one per day, then it might last for X days. You know, he might fail every single one of his saves, or he might not. So they have to get him back to the healer or else see him fall victim to the tiger sickness. So this means that there's going to be quite a tense bit where they're sort of trying to take this stretcher with a feverish raving guy on it through a jungle trail with all the dangers that that involves, plus the original tiger spirit is out there somewhere. So I like that with the web birds, right? That they inflict this condition which is going to kill you, but maybe not immediately. And therefore, if the other player characters win the fight, they can try to do something about it. I like that. The only reason that I don't like the web birds implanting their eggs in people is that we've had almost this exact thing several times now. And this is something that we're going to see a lot. We've seen already several times in Monster Manual 2, and that I think is going to be maybe a recurring complaint, is that we're starting to repeat ourselves. We're starting to take... and that's not necessarily a bad thing. You can take elements of monsters that have already existed and then combine them in interesting ways. But I feel a little bit as though these two things kind of don't quite go together. I mean, I suppose it makes sense that you want to immobilize your target before laying your eggs in them. That's fine. But I do think that I might separate them. I really like the group mechanic for the webbing, and that might turn up in a game I run, although not this Lorne's Song of the Bachelor one. But I might very well use the web birds, but I don't know if I'd use the egg laying thing. I might, if only because I haven't had that many monsters that do that in my game so far. Whereas in a D&D game, I think the likelihood that that has come up at least once before would be a little bit greater. Anyway, that's about all the monsters that we have time for today. In our next episode, we're going to be continuing our journey through the W chapter as we look at the Wemmick and the Willow, Black. But before we do that, we've got a special episode coming up, and that's going to be about the mythical Lindworm. And that's going to be here on Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening. If you have a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, you can reach me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or by email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. To support Monster Man, just go to patreon.com/monsterman. Thank you to Ray Otis for designing the thumbnail image. Our introductory music is Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, used under a Creative Commons attribution license. Thank you again for listening, and please join us next time.